Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. As you can see, there's only three of us. It's not really been a table. It's more of a triangle. We're missing Matt Kachansky. He is out on a client deliverable today, so he is missing for the day. But I've got my other two compadres. I've got Wade McFall, who is the McFowl. It depends who you're talking to, right? Always, it depends. Retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office, now a member of our SIU Medicaid team, and Jason Eisengrind, retired executive from HHS OIG and the retired Western UPIC director, and now our special director in charge over here doing some special projects. And we're gonna spend some time today talking about data integration, cross-training, disparate data sets and the like. And I think, you know, this is an area where SIUs, the UPICs, OIG agents, it's getting all of the data that you need into a working fashion that allows you to do your investigations in a cost-effective manner, but also streamlining them. And the very first thing that becomes an issue is the extraction of data and the manipulation of data to make it workable. You know, in the general sense, investigators in an SIU in the commercial space may have the ability to see data across all lines of business that may be out there, inpatient, outpatient, pharmacy, and the like. And so sometimes that data comes in as one cumulative billing report for a particular beneficiary, but you know, in other instances, it may be multiple data sets, and the number one piece is being able to have the ability to normalize that data. So from a strictly data analytics perspective, when data is ingested, there's usually three types: structured, semi-structured, and unstructured. What we're typically used to seeing is structured data, meaning defined columns with, you know, similar data in it. Dates of service are all consistent, whether it's a two-digit month, two-digit day, four-digit for the year, but it's typically consistent within that data set. You know, semi-structured data might be something where it's last name, comma, space, first name, right? So it's consistent along those lines, but structured, it would be last name in a column, first name in a column. And then unstructured data is going to be, you know, the potential of there just being a data dump where everything is in one line, one column. And so it's important to be able to have that integration of your data analytics team in helping to get that. But then once you've gotten to that point, a lot of that is this cross matching and this cross functionality within a team. And Jason, I'm going to get to you in a minute to talk about that. But wait, I want to go to you first, because the ability to look at different sets of data can really help with being able to understand a fraud scheme. So like, you know, one of the examples I'll give, and then I'll turn over to you, is ambulance transports. You know, if a person is transported by ambulance for an emergency to a hospital, we would expect that there would be a corresponding emergency department bill submitted to the payer by the hospital and the providers in that emergency department, right? So, you know, are there trips to nowhere? Is an ambulance provider submitting a claim for a service that never took place? Or why is there no corresponding hospital bill? But you could see that across other things, right? So Wade, you're working on a bunch of stuff now where that integration of data and that ability to understand different data sets can help you identify some pretty easy fraud schemes, right?
Yeah, there's really two different types of data runs, across data runs that I've been dealing with. One is pharmacy to medical claim match, where you're basically just trying to show that if a physician is writing prescriptions, if it's a legitimate relationship, he or she would most likely be billing for an office visit prior to that first prescription or the same day of that prescription. So if we have a series of prescriptions for narcotics and controlled substances, and there's no corresponding you know, office visits, that's a problem. But the other one that we're seeing a lot is the inpatient match report. And these are kind of pre-established kind of standard reports that we can request just based on a couple different, you know, provider numbers or NPIs. But basically, the inpatient match report is going to show when a patient or a member, whatever we want to call them, beneficiary is getting billed for the main example I've been seeing is adult daycare centers. So they, especially during COVID, the regulations are really relaxed, and basically these adult daycare centers could bill for members as long as they reached out to them and made sure that they were doing all right, they didn't need anything, or if they made a delivery of food. So they really didn't have to do much of anything in order to bill for that daily per diem. But what this inpatient match report showed is that they were billing for this service, which really wasn't much of a service, but they were billing for that while the member was at inpatient status somewhere else, at a hospital, or maybe it was a group home setting, but it was, they definitely were inpatient somewhere else. So there's really no need for this adult daycare center. So that's a pretty glaring, you know, especially if there's a pattern where they were inpatient for a number of days, you have to kind of be careful looking at it. Like if it's like a one day where it could be the admit date to inpatient or the discharge date, you know, theoretically it's possible that they could have been at the daycare center that day, so the daycare center is going to bill for it, and then something happened and they had to be admitted, or vice versa, they were inpatient, they got discharged and they had to go to the daycare because they don't have any other care options. So keeping that in mind, that the first and the last day of an inpatient stay, it might be hard to argue that they shouldn't have been billed somewhere else. But when you have, you know, a series of dates, a week, a month, or whatever, and the daycare center just continues to bill when they're in this other inpatient setting, and there's no need for the daycare center at that point. So those types of reports can make it really obvious, and it's kind of indefensible. They try to defend it and say, well, why isn't the hospital or the group home having to pay back, because we're saying that we did our service, but really there's no comparison in what they're getting in an inpatient status versus, you know, a daycare center calling to see if they're doing all right. But right. Those reports make it pretty obvious.
Yeah. So a couple of things. I mean, obviously, to go kind of work backwards, is what you're really talking about in your inpatient outpatient, you know, discharge admission, is really the potential of there being a false positive, right? The false positive meaning that the daycare billed on the same day as the patient was admitted or discharged. And so, you know, that's where we always say the human intelligence piece of data analytics is an integral part of any data analytics. You cannot rely solely upon data to make some definitive determinations of things. You really need to go and look back at the source of truth and find out, is there that potential of there being a false positive or not? The other thing that you brought up, which is I think really the important piece of this, is standard reports, right? Like the fact that where you are right now on your contract, you can get these standard report runs that are done. And so those standard reports become efficiencies that you create from the projects you're working on, and become a way to integrate resource allocation to things that you're doing, right? And that becomes a little bit of a time saver, that you're not having to reinvent the wheel every single time through that standardization. So Jason, it's a great segue to bring to you, which is that from a project management and from this kind of overreaching perspective on the importance of integrating and collaborating within your clinical teams, your medical review teams, your analytics teams, your investigative teams, it gets back to this premise of know your policies, know your data, and know where you're going. And so those standard reports wind up helping to create those efficiencies, which then creates ROI and other things, right?
Absolutely, Eric. And I apologize for the sunglasses and the wind, but I have to be mobile this morning. Bottom line is that interoperability is absolutely essential to minimizing the amount of resources that an organization needs, and for not adding a load of time to project and to delivery of results. So planning for that, it's not impossible, but it is difficult. First, having, you know, data people that really understand about data mapping, and you know, maybe someday or maybe over the rainbow, their organizations all use these, you know, a defined naming convention that is going to be uniform across organizations. But the real world is that that's not the case now. And most likely, the data fields are going to be different. Now, there are some technologies now that are more forgiving about some differences between names. But the real kiss of death is what Eric referred to as the unstructured data. And frankly, having been on several projects where the transfer of the project from one organization to another involved unstructured data, and it's just as if you had a virtual dump truck full of information and it was just put on your front lawn or your parking lot, and finding that is like finding a needle in a haystack of needles. So you just have to be aware that that is a problem and then be prepared to try to deal with it. Also, internally, interoperability between units within your organization. So most likely you have a data group, you have an investigative group, you have a clinical group, and each of those groups probably interpret data differently, or maybe have different levels of familiarity of data or different levels of technical ability in terms of manipulating the data. If it's in some, I might be in as simple as a spreadsheet, but if it's in some other application that's more proprietary, you'd of course want to have your staff familiar with the process of manipulating that data. But the one thing that will break that problem down a bit is good communication between those groups. So when there's a sharing of the data, you know, there's a discussion up front, there's a discussion as time is going on that they're getting it and that it's working. And then, of course, any other discussions that are needed to either work out the wrinkles that come up, or at the end, make sure that the results are readable by the unit that is receiving those results. So communication is going to be key. I would hope that at some time there's more technology that can help with the data mapping. But in the meantime, as the data comes in, getting a handle on what the data fields are and what they mean will go a long way to making the use of that data more efficient and effective.
You know, one of the things that we've seen with some of the SIU work that we're doing is that SIUs are integrating into their training, having investigators cross-trained to learn how to be CPCs, certified professional coders. Now, some plans that we've worked with, we've done CPC boot camps for their investigators where they want the investigators to actually sit for and become certified professional coders. In other instances, the plans just wanted the investigators to be cross-trained to learn about what a CPC really does, just to understand things a little bit better. So, you know, that's part of that integration. But I certainly think that there's a great value to people that are on the clinical side, you know, understanding the data, to be able to understand what an investigator is thinking. But at the very minimum is that integration where an investigator has the ability to speak to the clinical staff about, hey, this is what the allegation is, this is what we're hearing, you know, can we have a kind of a focused review or what have you. But, you know, I think as time is going on, the bifurcation of payment integrity and the SIU is becoming more and more blurred, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, right? Because some things like, you know, that may come to an SIU may be really just the result of a policy not being clear, where if that policy was better, the payer might not be paying out claims that they should or shouldn't do. You know, we just did a review, for example, for a payer involving some behavioral health claims. And our auditor identified that had the payer had a policy saying that the following services that were billed out as this should have been coded as this, if there was a specific policy, that there wouldn't be this overpayment that existed, or that some of these issues would not have existed. So, you know, I think that that integration of being able to understand that data and how it relates back to the specifics of a particular case are super, you know, super important. So, Wade, I want to go back to you, you know, kind of for the final word, because one of the things that you brought up is kind of the piece of the puzzle that's become kind of the bane of existence for the past couple of years, which is this lack of doctor-patient relationship prior to something being issued, like a prescription being dispensed. We're seeing this in the DME space constantly, right? The strike force nationally, these telemedicine cases are being worked where there's no prior relationship with the doctor and the patient. Now, during the public health emergency, during COVID, that was relaxed. There didn't necessarily need to be that doctor-patient relationship in existence. But we see this a lot in the pharmacy space. We see it in genetic testing and other related things. And we're seeing this, kind of across the board in a bunch of other things that are relative to telemedicine. And it's always perplexed me that there isn't a basic algorithm to say, if a claim is being submitted for Wade McFall for a knee brace, shouldn't there be a corresponding claim from the ordering provider for an E&M? And what we find by and large is that, we see these $20, $30, $40 million cases involving genetic testing and the like, and DME and pharmacy. We saw that pretty prominently during the period of time when compounding was a big issue, compounding fraud, the mail order, no doctor-patient relationship whatsoever. So, what do you see as being, on the plan that you're on, what are they doing to either try to stymie those kinds of claims, or how are you tackling those investigations?
Well, I think a lot of it is what I discussed earlier on the kind of the canned reports that we can get that show that, that there wasn't that relationship beforehand. Another aspect of that I think is important to pick out, and you're spot on that, before these tests are ordered or given, there has to be some kind of relationship. Like, why would you be getting a knee brace if there wasn't some type of exam? But equally as telling, I think, is that a lot of times you'll have these mobile diagnostic facilities or various testing that could be sonograms, x-rays, any type of thing that they bill for these expensive tests, but then they're never interpreted. They never go back to a doctor to find out what the results of the tests were. So you may have that initial relationship with the patient and they order these expensive tests, but then the patient just never goes back to see, like, how did the test turn out? It's like, do I have this condition or not? So that's, I think, as equally as important. And I don't know that we have a set report for that. That's more of the old type of investigation where you probably have to do some, just basic claims data and interviewing members or patients to ask them, so you had this test done. Why did you not go back to get the results of the test? That's a pretty key important part of that whole relationship.
Right. I mean, that's an important piece of it, right? If there's a claim for payment for a genetic test, one would surmise that there should be a corresponding evaluation and management or an E&M for the examination that ultimately led to the genetic test being ordered. And then the requirement that you have to interpret those results, there should be an E&M follow-up where the patient's test results are discussed, where you don't see that. I've always been perplexed as to why there isn't a greater use of that sort of functionality from an algorithm perspective, because it doesn't seem like it's that much of a challenge. But Jason, so I want to give you kind of the final piece and any comments that you may have about this. But, it seems to me that there are always opportunities for a payer to enhance what their algorithms are going to be and how they can potentially stop fraud as a front end process versus a back end process. Wouldn't you think that there would be a greater enhancement of ROI from a plan perspective if they had some of these enhancements in place?
Absolutely. And are increasing on the Medicaid side, but I don't know, because I haven't really studied it, whether SIUs have benefit from prepay edits. But a good example was in a UPIC experience, it was there was a wonderment about why a particular, and you mentioned genetic service, it was wonderment about, well, why isn't genetic testing a big deal in the, one of the five you picks. And, you know, the resolution or the answer was, is that actually the MAC, the Medicare Administrative Contractor, had a really good prepayment edit in place, which eliminated the problem before it started. So that's always going to be the best attack of a of an issue, especially one that's trending, especially one that has, you know, national implications. But one other thing that you said that I want to echo, because it was a very good point. And I, you know, the, so what I was bringing up was the fact that, you know, speaking across different data sets and whatnot, you know, sometimes can be problematic. But one of the things that you want to look for are points of commonality, and definitely you're going to find that commonality with ICD-10 codes. And so, you know, having really good coding expertise on the team and people that are certified coders is an awesome start to mitigating that concern.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, the prepay piece is an important piece of that metric. What, you know, what you bring up specifically about the one MAC having a prepay policy in place on that is, you know, the challenge is that in the Medicare space, at least, Medicare being a national program, but if you're talking about a MAC having a particular policy, what you're really talking about is what's known as an LCD, or local coverage determination. And the fact that one MAC has a policy, but the other 10 or 11 MACs didn't have a policy, you know, just kind of shows a little bit of the fragmented issues that exist in the CMS world. We could have an entirely separate conversation about LCDs and whether or not they have the effect of law or not, or rule, because they're not subject to the 60-day comment period that an NCD has. It's another topic for another day. But, you know, clearly the integration of data and that cross-matching of data and having the ability to have some of those canned reports certainly creates the ability to have a higher ROI, because if we can just make a request for a standard report, he's not having to spend 45 minutes or an hour having a discussion with someone about, well, I need a report that says X, Y, and Z. He can just say, hey, can you please run that cross-match report inpatient to whatever it is, social daycare, and then 10 minutes later, he gets a report. He saved himself a half an hour of discussion time, gets a report that's already part of the kind of predefined, and the ROI is inherently built in, at least from an opportunity cost, right? He's not having to spend a lot of time where he could be spending time on other things. So it's part of that integration. You know, I think it'd be great to hear what some of the payer community is doing as far as these canned reports, and see are payers kind of sticking with canned reports across payers? Are there, you know, are there one or two types of canned reports, or are there hundreds that are out there? So it'd be interesting to see what all of you on the payer side have to say about this. So as always, we run out of time before we run out of topics. So it's always great to see you guys. For those of you that will be at the NHCAA the week of the 6th or 7th of November, it's another couple of weeks away. We will be there. We'll have a booth. I think we're booth number 614. Come on over and enjoy some memes with us. I'll be speaking at the NHCAA on, I think, the 7th of November. So please stop by. I'll be at 9:40 to 10:40 on the importance of the public-private partnerships that should exist within SIU, and talking about how that integration of law enforcement and the SIUs is really an integral part of ferreting out fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance issues. So we'll be speaking at that. And as always, if you're not getting our newsletter, hello at advise, advizehealth.com. Please sign up for that newsletter and join us at our next LinkedIn Live in November. We'll be putting out some information about that in the next couple of days. So as always, good seeing you guys, and hope to see you all at the NHCAA. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.